Hey, my name is Jerry Minocalk.
Hey, Jerry.
We try to get really good speakers, and we've had Bill, I think, speak here before, and he hasn't spoken in a while. I was going down the list, and I said, it'd be time to have him back. Bill and I paths crossed back in probably 2005, 2006, and I was desperately needing a sponsor and volunteered my services to Bill. And Bill kindly, I think, said, yeah, I think I'm too busy, or I don't know, Jerry, I don't know if it's a good fit. So I said, no, you will be my sponsor. I'll keep you on the phone for a long, long time until you say yes. And Bill's one of those guys that is not, he's visible, but the actions he does are always behind the scenes. He's always doing something. He's been invested in the Atlanta Men's Workshop for 25, 27 years, something like that.
32,
right. And it's been nonstop. Thanks, Bill. And he's sponsors a gazillion guys. He's on the road and he speaks. And we're just delighted to have him here with us. Thanks, Bill. Appreciate it.
I'm Bill, I'm an alcoholic.
Hey, Bill.
By the grace of God, I'm sober tonight, and that's the most important thing that I can tell you. That it is by the grace of a loving God and the tender, loving care of people like you in rooms like this that I have not had a drink in 12,262 days. And now, I don't want you sitting here trying to figure that out. I'll tell you. My sobriety date is July 26, 1982. And I can tell you right now, that impresses me a hell of a lot more than it impresses you. It has been over 32 years since I got in a fight with a parking meter. It's been over 32 years since I drove in the wrong end of a car wash. I don't know what that woman was screaming so far. I was as surprised to see her as she was to see me. Been over 32 years since I pulled up to a sidewalk mailbox and ordered a Big Mac and fries. And the list goes on and on and on. I came into Alcoholics Anonymous a reasonably young man, 39 years old. Same age Bill Wilson was when he got sober. Something's happened along the way, and I'm an old man now. I'm 72 years old. And believe it or not, that's the oldest I've ever been. And over the last almost 34 years, I've fallen in love with an outfit called Alcoholics Anonymous. I love this fellowship. I love the people in it. I love everything about it. Because it gave me something that I'd never, ever had in my life. And that is a real, honest-to-goodness, know-me-inside-out family. I have shared at AA conferences in 47 of the 50 states, all across Canada. I've spoken to small groups. I shared at Founders Day in front of 18,000 people. And yet, when I stand in front of a crowd, whether it's 30 or 18,000, and say, my name is Bill Sanders and I'm an alcoholic, they know 90% of everything they need to know about me, and I'm at home no matter where I am. Who else can say that? Who else can walk into a room full of strangers in a strange town or a strange city, identify yourself as an alcoholic, and they know you? And you can talk to them and tell them what's going on with you, and they'll get it and they'll understand it. People out here on the streets of Sandy Springs won't. You know, if I run into Jerry out here on the street, and Jerry says, how you doing today, Bill? I say, well, be honest with me, today I'm scared. And Jerry probably said, yeah, I know that feeling, been there, done that. Walk up to a normal, quote, person out there on the street. Bill, how you doing? Well, I'm scared. What are you scared of? I don't know. I'm just scared. You won't believe how fast they'll get away from you. I believe that I was born an alcoholic. I think that the ism was in place for the first breath I took in this world. At the age of 15, I had my first drink and began my journey into the depths of alcoholism. But I believe the ism was always there, because from the very earliest memories I have, I felt different from the people around me. I always sort of felt like I was on the outside looking in, that I didn't quite fit. I was a class clown growing up. But I always felt like that I really didn't belong wherever I was. A few years ago, I went to my 50th high school reunion. It was real sad for me because none of my classmates were there. It was just a bunch of old people. And you could ask those people if that was the way I was, if I was a loner and didn't fit in. And they'd go, hell no. I was in the middle of everything. Joined everything. Church, school, scouts, you name it, I joined it, but I belonged nowhere. Class president, didn't fit. Didn't belong there. I was a fake. At the age of 13, I should tell you, I went into the profession that was to be my profession for 50 years until I retired a few years ago, and that was the broadcasting business. At the age of 13, I became what was purported to be then the youngest disc jockey in America. The record has long since been broken by people 7, 8 years old. But supposedly, I was the youngest DJ in America then. And everybody assumed that the smart aleck kid they heard behind the microphone every day, bumping his gums and spinning rock and roll records, was who I was. They didn't know that that was that same scared little kid hiding behind the anonymity of a microphone, being somebody else. And I became the master of that. I was the master chameleon of being somebody else all through life. Who? Well, I was whoever I perceived that you wanted me to be. I wanted to be loved and liked, so I would mold myself to fit what I perceived was your perception of what I ought to be like. I could change religions, I could change philosophies, I could change politics, I could change anything in an instant. And I would convince you that I was spot on telling the truth. I became the consummate liar. And I became such a chameleon that by the time I came through the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous, I had no idea whatsoever of who Bill Sanders was. I had absolutely and totally, completely lost myself. I was a lost soul, spiritually, mentally, emotionally. And I was scared. I lived in perpetual fear of being found out. And yet I kept doing it. I kept changing. I'll go back to that first drink I had at the age of 15. I lived up on the Georgia-South Carolina line in a little town. And some friends came and said, "Do you want to go with us Saturday night over to Carolina and get some beer?" And I said, "Sure, why not? Peer pressure, curiosity, I don't know which." And we went across the Savannah River into South Carolina, and there was a little beer joint over there. You could pull up behind it and honk the horn, and if the guy would come out, and if you could see over the steering wheel, he'd sell it to you. And we bought a case of what I believe I remember was a case of Pabst Blue Ribbon beer. And we came back and sat on the banks of the old Savannah River. They say you ought to go back to where you had your first drink. I can't do that. Where I had my first drink, it was on the banks of the Savannah River, and it's now about 300 feet at the bottom of Lake Hartwell, so I can't go right back where I had my first drink. But somebody popped open one of those beers and handed it to me. And I took a great big slug of it. And it was, without a doubt, the most vile, putrid, god-awful tasting stuff I had ever put in my mouth. I think that probably explains why I only had 6 that night. I don't need to tell most of y'all what happened between the second and third beer. You know what I felt. Suddenly I was smarter, wittier, handsomer, sexier, even taller than I had ever been in my entire life. And for that matter, anybody I'd ever known in my entire life. And I thought to myself, man, I found a friend. And it was going to be my friend for the rest of my life, and it almost was. A belief was set in place that night that I was to hold for the next quarter of a century. And that was the belief that alcohol affected everybody who drinks the same way it affected me. It took getting sober to learn it doesn't. Alcohol does not do for everyone what it does to us. For some people, it doesn't change their personality. For some people, it doesn't turn them into something or someone that they aren't. And that sort of explains a little bit the people that I never understood. For example, I never understood the person who'd say, "No, one's my limit." That's the dumbest remark I have ever heard in my life. I have never wanted one of anything. I live by the philosophy of anything worth doing is worth overdoing. But the one that really got me, and to this day it still gets me, I don't get this person. The one who says, "No more for me, I'm beginning to feel it." Now, did you hear what I just said? "No more for me, I'm beginning to..." That's not where you quit. That's where you get going good. I don't understand those people. And what's more, I know they don't understand me. And they never will. I long ago quit trying to explain my disease to anyone who doesn't have it, because it's impossible. You cannot make anyone understand that which makes no sense. Only to us does it make any sense. Only because we've been there. Well, I didn't drink that much in high school, because if my little Southern Baptist mother had caught me, I wouldn't have needed AA. I would have needed an undertaker. But then I went off to college just 40 miles away in Athens, Georgia, and spent 4 years there cultivating my disease. And I'd like to share with you some of the very fond memories of my college career. I really would love to. But by then, I was beginning to suffer what folks in North Georgia refer to as blackouts. 1961, that was a blackout. I stayed in trouble the whole time I was at Georgia, constantly in the dean of men's office, being chastised and threatened with expulsion. For some reason, the old dean of men at the University of Georgia, God rest his soul, a man named Bill Tate, took a liking to me. And he made it his quest that he was going to see that I graduated with a diploma if it was the last thing he ever did. He even said that. It dang near was. He constantly threatened to throw me out of school, but he never did. And I would constantly do things to perturb him. One quick one, there was there's a grand tradition at the University of Georgia that when Georgia wins a ball game, immediately after the game, they begin to ring the bell in the chapel tower up on the front the front campus. And they'll ring the bell from the time the game ends until midnight, unless it's Georgia Tech. And they used to ring it all night after Georgia Tech. I don't know if they do it now or not. But there's a roster in the library at the University of Georgia. It's an honor to be a bell ringer. And they record the names of the people who ring it at 15-minute intervals after each game. And that goes in a record that's ensconced in the University of Georgia Library. And you can go back 100 years and see who rang the bell on what game and what day. I rang that bell. My name's not in that roster. Well, it probably had something to do with the fact that I was ringing it at 3 o'clock in the morning on Easter Sunday. If you're not a big football fan, the season's pretty well over by then. And I knew I was in trouble when I saw Dean Tate get out of his old 56 Chevrolet with his pajama bottoms hanging out from under his raincoat, marching toward me. He got about 10 feet from me. He looked at me and said, "You!" I dropped my head. He said, "My office, 7:30 tomorrow morning." Got back in his car and peeled out of there. Things like that, constantly, constantly in trouble. One Saturday night, my roommate and I were visiting in another friend's apartment in Athens. And it was about 2 or 3:30 in the morning. We were all drunk. In the guy's apartment that we were visiting in had an antique gun collection that he was very proud of, worth thousands of dollars. And I reached up on the wall and I grabbed out an old long barrel Colt 22 pistol and started waving it around, acting like Wyatt Earp or Matt Dillon. Pointed at my roommate and said, "Stick him up." My roommate threw up his hands and I squeezed the trigger and there was a sound like thunder. And in a moment, my roommate was lying on the floor in front of me in a pool of blood. They were to tell us some hours later at a hospital in Athens that my roommate would live, but that he would never walk again. The bullet had severed his spine. A strange thing happened in the early morning hours of that next morning. I stood by my roommate's bed, and he reached up, put his hand on my arm, and he said, "Bill, I know it was an accident. Don't blame yourself. It could just as easily have been the other way around. Please, please, don't blame yourself." He had forgiven me immediately, but I didn't forgive myself because I didn't know how. It was not until you people gave me the power and the magic of the fourth, the fifth, the sixth, seventh, eighth, and ninth steps that I was able to find forgiveness and to find peace. Instead, I used it as an excuse to crawl deeper and deeper into the bottle. And as long as it was enough booze to quiet the voices, I could cope. And then the day came when there wasn't enough. So I faked for several weeks having trouble sleeping, went to the college infirmary, got a pretty good supply of sleeping pills, waited until one Friday afternoon when my new roommate was headed home for the weekend. Excuse me, I watched him pull out of the parking lot. And I emptied what was later determined to be but somewhere between 50 and 60 sleeping pills out on the nightstand. One by one and two by two, swallowed them down, turned out the lights, and pulled up the covers. For over 25 years, I believe that it was a huge coincidence that my roommate's brand new car conked out at the city limits of Athens and had to be towed back to the dealership. And he came back into that dormitory room, found me, saw those bottles, knew the frame of mind I'd been in, and called the ambulance. I say coincidence because I don't believe in coincidences by the definition in the dictionary. I believe that a coincidence is a miracle in which God chooses to remain anonymous. I think it was the first of many times that the God you people introduced me to looked down and said, "Big boy, I'm not through with you yet." And to this day, I don't know for what purpose I'm here. It may be tonight, it may be next week or next month. But my goal is to be sober and to be here and to be in place for whatever God's will for me, for whatever reason he kept me around. And that was not the only incident. There was another half-assed suicide attempt. I totaled either 7 or 9 cars. My wife and I disagree on which number. Should have been killed in most of them. But for some reason, I'm still here. It was immediately decided after that attempt that I was in serious need of help, so I began my journey through shrinks. For over a period of over 20 years, I visited every kind of shrink you can think of. Counselor, psychiatrist, psychologist, psychological social worker, ministers, you name it, I went to them, damned every one of them, because not one single one ever did one single thing to help me. Now, y'all have heard this little term we use around here called rigorous honesty. That kind of forces me to admit that one or more of them might have been able to help me if I had ever once told them the truth. About the third or fourth question, "You think you might have a drinking problem?" "Nope, I drink fine." They'd go off treating something else. One of them was even a famous shrink. He and his partner had had a very famous case that they dealt with. It was about a woman who had 3 distinct personalities living inside her body. And they had written a book about it, and at the time when I was seeing the doctor, the movie about this woman had just come out. The book and the movie were called The Three Faces of Eve. Joanne Woodward got Best Actress. The picture won Best Picture that year. And I kept quizzing my doctor about this woman. And, of course, it was very, very, very limited as to what he would tell me because of patient-doctor confidentiality. But I was probing to find out everything I could about this woman with three personalities. And I had a reason for it. The reason I wanted to find out all I could, because I felt like if I could get my personalities down to just three, I might be able to manage it. But you see, I have these conventions that go on up here in my head. And they argue and they discuss. They vote on things, on whether I ought to have a drink or not, and where I ought to go and what I ought to do. And I wish I could tell you that when I got sober, they went away, but they didn't. They're still there. I don't hear them as much as I used to. And as much as I hate to do it, I've got to admit to you guys, like I said, it pains me to tell you this, but they don't like you. They don't like you at all. They wish I'd stay away from you. Because, see, they're louder when I'm not with you. But, you see, I like me better when I'm with you. You people found a way to bring out the best in me that there is. So I'm sticking with you. And that's why I go to a lot of meetings. That's why I sponsor a lot of guys. That's why I do a lot of service work. It keeps the voices quiet. I'm going to tell you one quick incident of something that happened to me not long after I got sober. About 3 months into sobriety, I was going to my first business trip out of town to Washington, D.C. I had to go up there quite frequently on business because I did lobbying before Congress on broadcast issues. And I was nervous. So I had lunch with my sponsor. He reminded me one more time, "Bill, you know, if you get in an argument in your head about whether or not you're going to drink, you're going to lose that argument. You can't win it. Don't get there." I heard him. But I got on that plane at Hartsfield Airport, and I hadn't cleared the ground till that meeting up here in my head started. 500 miles from home. Nobody up there knows you're in AA. You could tie one on tonight and be gone out of your system by you come home Friday. Nobody'd ever know. I looked around the plane to see if everybody else was hearing those voices. Apparently they weren't. Plane landed what's now Reagan National Airport. Out of the plane into a cab. I don't hear what the cab driver's saying because I'm still playing that in my head. Yes, you can. No, you can't. Yeah, you should. No, not. Maybe. Yep. Yeah, no, no. Dropped me off at the Hyatt Regency Hotel on Capitol Hill. I walked into that big old giant atrium lobby. My radar spots the bar. Other side of the lobby. Tinkling the glasses. The laughter. Took about 10 minutes to check in, go up my room, drop my bags, come back down. I stood in the doorway of that bar for about what later determined to be about 5 minutes. And I walked over. The arguments playing out in my head. And I lost. And I walked over and I sat down at the bar. And the bartender came and stood in front of me. He looked at me and smiled and then said the weirdest thing. He said, "Hey, buddy, how about a Coke?" I said, "A what?" He said, "Well, I figured by that lapel pin you're wearing, that's what you'd want. I had forgotten to take off this damned AA pin." And he knew what it was. Okay. He set the Coke down, walked down, served a few more people, and came back and stood in front of me. I'm still sitting there staring at that Coke. He said, "You don't have any business in here, do you?" "No." He said, "Where you belong is two blocks down the street, upstairs over the furniture store. There's a meeting in 20 minutes. Get the hell out of here." I did two things that night. I went to that meeting. And I came back and I walked into that bar and I thanked an angel in the shape of a bartender. He smiled and said, "You weren't in much danger." He said, "And you stood in the door so long I thought you were waiting for somebody or looking for somebody. But when you sat down and I saw that pen and the look on your face, I knew what you were up to, and there was no way in hell you were going to get a drink out of me." He said, "Oh, you might like to know. I'm a substitute bartender. I'm just here tonight." The other thing I did is I got down on my knees beside a hotel room bed. And I said, "God, if you've gone to this much trouble to keep me sober tonight, I will never test you again." And I don't go in bars unless I have a damn good reason to be there. And that's very seldom. I belong in rooms like this with you, people like you, who know who and what I am. I don't test my God. I tested myself for long enough. I could give you a lot more of what it was like. I'll only share, you know, one thing with you that people find amusing. In the broadcasting business, I spent many years meeting a lot of people, rubbing elbows with a lot of famous people. I dined at the governor's mansion and at the White House. I've interviewed presidents and movie stars. One quick interview stands out from most of the rest of them. I was sent when I was working at WSB here in Atlanta to a hotel downtown Atlanta to interview Lyndon Johnson. And the news director told me who I was going to go interview. And I was thinking of going down there, you know, I need a little fortification to do this. So I stopped at the bar and had a couple of shots. Went down, got on the elevator, went up to the designated floor, met by the Secret Service, was frisked, and my credentials checked, and my recorder inspected. Ushered into the suite, this giant of a man grabbed my hand and pumped it and said, "Come on in, boy, and have a seat." I sat down on a sofa, and there was a coffee table, and then he sat on another sofa facing me. And I couldn't help noticing in the middle of that coffee table was a couple of glasses and a jug of Jack Daniels. He said, "Before we do this here interview, let's have a little snort." Sounded good to me. He poured my glass full and his glass full, and I took a couple of sips, and he took a couple of sips. Now, I have to explain that back then, you didn't just walk in and sit down and interview the president. You had to do what was known as the pre-interview interview. That's where you tell him what you're going to ask him. He tells you whether or not he's going to talk about that or not, and you kind of sift out the questions before you actually begin. They don't do that anymore. They don't get away with it, but they did then. So I'm throwing out questions, and he's saying, "Yeah, no, let's don't get into that. Let's say, yeah, that's fine." And I'm sipping away. Every time I get the drink down a little bit, he fills the glass back up. Started getting hot in that room. Finally, it hit me. I realized, my God, that man is drunker than you are. A few more minutes, he said, "Okay, turn that thing on, let's do it." I turned on the recorder and we started the interview. And the interview went very well. I had good questions, he had good answers. Beautifully, interview went great. Required very little editing. Except when I got down to a point in the interview where I asked him a question about his wife, Ladybug. Now, some of you are real young and don't know or remember. His wife's name was not Ladybug, it was Lady Bird. Thank God he thought it was funnier than y'all did. I had little incidents like that all through my career. Near the end of my career, I had to do a lot of traveling, as I said, to Washington, D.C., to different places. And I used to say I was afraid of flying. I've since learned that I never really was afraid of flying. What I was afraid of was crashing. So I would always get to the airport early and stop in the bar, have a few drinks on that before I get on that plane, get fortified. It worked. Worked great. Except those times when I would forget to get on the plane. You know, there's a fun little side to that. For a number of years, our hometown airline, Delta Airlines, had a an advertising theme that they used for a number of years. And the theme was, Delta is ready when you are. Now, the irony of it is, I did the voiceover for those commercials on television and on radio. The only line I had in the whole commercial was the very last line, which said, Delta is ready when you are. That's a damn lie. They'll leave you. I got paid for lying for Delta. A lot of money. Ain't giving it back. So I did what any good drunk would do. I just get on another plane, go somewhere else. Called home that night. Well, how's your trip to New York going? I don't know. I'm not in New York. Where are you? I'm in New Orleans. More and more often, I would wake up in strange places, in strange cities, in strange beds with strange people, exhibiting strange, bizarre behavior. And more often, my life was falling apart, piece by piece. More and more often, I was living in perpetual fear and anxiety. There was a circuitous route about how I came to AA that I don't have time to get into tonight. But I will suffice it to say, my wife got sober in April of 1982. And from April until July of 1982, I made her life a living hell. Because I knew that if she was an alcoholic, that it probably meant I was too, and I knew I wasn't. My wife never said a word. She just kept going to meetings and going to meetings and going to meetings and going to meetings. Never said, you need this worse than I do. You're a bigger drunk than I am. As Jerry's heard me say, there were a few little hints left around the house. For example, I'd walk in the bathroom and lift the toilet seat, and this is how it works, taped to the lid. She knew where I'd see it, worshiping at the porcelain throne. But finally, in July 1982, my world crashed down around me. I came out of a week-long blackout drunk. And I went to the only place that I had left on this earth that I could go, and that was a place called the 8111 Club, because that's where my wife had gone to meetings. And I went back and I walked down and I sat down in the back of that room behind a post. My God's got a sense of humor, because sitting there at the front of the room chairing the meeting was my wife. She didn't see me until the end of the meeting, when a man got up and talked about those chips. And he held up this white chip and said, if you're sick and tired of being sick and tired. And I got up and I took the longest walk I've ever taken in my life to the front of that room. And a man pressed a white poker chip into my trembling, sweating palm. And I walked back and sat down. I choose to believe that an old Bill Sanders walked to the front of that room that night and died, and that a new one walked away, because through God's grace and the help of you people, I have not had a drink since that night. And for that, I am forever, forever grateful. You told me I needed to get a sponsor. I said, no problem. I mean, broadcasting, I got lots of sponsors. Pick one. A little more explanation. And I decided to get a sponsor scientifically. I looked around for the sweetest, kindest, roly-poliest, white-haired old granddaddy that I could find. One that I knew would pat me on the head and say, wow, you're working this program great, and I wouldn't change a thing. Took a few weeks, but I found him. I asked a man by the name of Doc Crandall to be my sponsor. Snow white hair, smile a mile wide. Biggest mistake I ever made in my life. I knew I was in trouble that first night. He said, yeah, I'll be your sponsor. Let's talk about the rules. Rules, wait a minute, whoa, what rules? He said, oh, it's very simple. You're going to wake up every morning, you're going to roll out of that bed onto your knees, and you're going to ask God to keep you sober today. And the last thing you'll do it before you get back in the bed at night is get on your knees again and say thank you. And I said, Doc, I know that prayer is important. God knows y'all open every meeting, close every meeting. But I got to be honest with you, Doc. I'm just not comfortable with this knee business. He said, son, I don't remember saying a damn thing about you being comfortable. Well, I drew myself up. He couldn't talk to me like that. And I had almost 30 days. I said, boy, I've heard this is a program of suggestion. He says, it is. I suggest you do it or get you another sponsor. That's how we started our relationship. Then he gave me that book. My God, was he ever fanatic about that book. He said, I want you to take this home and I want you to study it for the next 2 or 3 weeks. I want you to, I didn't say read, I said study it, the first 164 pages. When you get done doing that, we're going to come back and sit down here in my den and we're going to talk about how you can make those things work in your life. I said, okay, I can do that. Stopped at the office supply place. I got me a couple of legal pads, some highlighters, and some sharp pencils, and I went home, cleared off my desk, spread it all out, and I went to work. I highlighted, and I underlined, and I made notes in the margins. I struck through the steps that didn't have anything to do with me, and I jotted down a few I thought of that y'all obviously hadn't. And about 3 weeks later, I called him. I said, Doc, I'm ready. He said, hot dog, come on over. I went over to his house. I spread all my stuff out on his coffee table. He reared back in his big old recliner chair, and he said, all right, son, lay it on me. I opened the book up to chapter 5, and I pointed down to the first step, and I said, all right, Doc, looking here at this first step, as I interpret, and that's as far as I got, boy, that step don't need your interpreting. It needs your doing. But I know, Doc, but what I think it means is, he said, son, it's in English. It says exactly what it means. And don't look for anything between the lines because there ain't nothing there. Just do what it says. And I did. And we finished the first step, and we went to the second step. We got the third step. He went and said, get busy writing, went to the fourth step. We were whizzing along. Before I knew it, we were moving so fast, I thought, my God, we're going to be through here before you know it. And I walked into Doc's favorite trap. I said, Doc, what do you do when you get through working the steps? He smiled. He said, you lay real still because you're dead. Think about that. Had a problem at work with some personnel, and I thought, I'll ask Doc about it. Got to the meeting early. I said, can we go outside and talk a minute? And we got a cup of coffee, walked out under a tree, and I said, I got this little personnel problem at work I need some help with. He said, before you lay it out, let me ask you, what step are you using on it? Oh, I said, no, Doc, you don't understand. This ain't got nothing to do with steps. I'm talking about something real life here. He said, you go look again. I went home, went back down through the steps, didn't think about my personnel problem. Went back the next night, and I said, Doc, I looked, there wasn't anything in there. Let me lay out my situation. He said, go look again. Well, after about the third night of that, I'm driving home, thinking, oh, my God, how did you get hooked up with this crazy old bastard? But I got the book out, and I went down through the steps again, dot, dot, dot. And there was the answer. And over and over and over again, he sent me back to that book and back to those steps till the light finally went on in this thick skull of mine that there is nothing, nothing that is going to happen in the life of this alcoholic, that the answer is in that book and in those steps. I call it a magic book. Because if you don't remember, a few years ago, most of y'all have come in since then probably, but we came out with the fourth edition of the big book. Everybody got all excited about it. I didn't get excited. Because at the time when that came out, I was reading the 26th edition of the big book. Let me explain. At that point, I had read the big book from cover to cover 26 times. And every time I read it, they had rewritten that sucker. There was stuff in there that was not there the last time I read it. I know, because I told you I'm a highlighter and an underliner. And I highlight and underline stuff. Don't know why that's underlined. But over here, this is all brand new. I shared that at a conference in Northern California number of years ago, and a little girl came up to me afterwards and said, "Do you really believe that?" And I said, "Sweetheart, I'll tell you what I believe. I believe that God speaks to me through that book. I think he reveals to me what I need to see, when I need to see it, which behooves me to pick that book up and read it on a regular basis. Otherwise, I might miss a message. I also believe God speaks to me through your people. I quite often say, I pray for God's will and then I go to a meeting to find out what it is. And the answer usually comes from someplace totally unexpected. I've never had God speak to me through a trumpet or a burning bush. I asked my sponsor one time if a burning sofa counted, and he said it didn't. So I have to depend on you people. As some of you know, my first sponsor, Doc Crandall, went on a 12-step call in November 1985 and never came home. As he and another man struggled to take a shotgun away from a suicidal young man, Doc had been trying for several years to help get sober. Someone's finger hit the trigger, nobody knows who. The shotgun discharged, and Doc caught the blast full in the stomach and died before he reached the hospital. That evening, I sat in his den, and I felt a loneliness come over me I hadn't felt in a long time, and a fear. How can I go on? How can I keep going without the man who planted me in this program? How can I go on without the guy who kicked my butt when I needed it and who put his arms around my shoulder when I needed it? And in the stillness of that evening, the answer came. You do it by doing what he taught you to do. And what his sponsor before him taught him, and his sponsor before him and before him, all the way back to the night of May 11th, 1935, when the broken-down stockbroker and the has-been doctor looked at each other in that gatehouse in Akron and said, "Do you think we might stay sober if we help one another?" After Doc's death, I was surrounded by the greatest, most wonderful little bunch of snot-nosed sponsees that anybody could ever have. And those guys dragged me to meetings when I wanted to isolate. They made me share when I wanted to hide. They knocked on my door all hours of the day and night, intruding into my life, and loving me and caring me and carrying me until I could walk the walk again, and I will forever be grateful to them for it. I am a huge believer in sponsorship. I would not be here tonight if it were not for good sponsorship. I sponsor a lot of guys, and I do it because I need a lot of help. But I also love participating in other people's miracles, because I'm a miracle and so are you if you're here tonight and you're sober. But I love being a part of someone else's miracle as they grow in recovery and they discover God's grace. Now, since that first sponsor, having been here for almost 34 years, I have now buried 5 sponsors. My second sponsor was a man by the name of Paul Olliger. He was Dr. Paul. And if you've ever read a chapter in the big book called The Alcoholic and an Addict, or what is it called today? Acceptance Was the Answer. Acceptance Was the Answer to All My Problems Today. That man, Paul, was my sponsor the last 10 years of his life. I lost my sponsor, Dick Martin, last summer. And my sponsor today is a wicked old man by the name of Clancy Emslin, who has 57 years of sobriety in this program and rams it down my throat every time I surface for air. But I love him dearly. He keeps my feet to the fire, because even after all these years, I still need it. When I hit 30 years, I grabbed my big book, and I went to page 85. And you know, page 85 of the big book says what we really have is a daily reprieve contingent on the maintenance of our spiritual condition. When I hit 30 years, I grabbed the book because I felt sure mine would say, now what Bill has is a semi-annual reprieve. It still says daily. And it will always say daily. Some people identify themselves as recovered alcoholics, and I understand that. I have recovered from the hopeless state of mind and body. But I identify myself as a recovering alcoholic because, you see, I'm still a work in progress. hopefully God's not through with me yet. I have to remain teachable. I have to be an open book for God to write in and to tell me directions for my life. I want to remain a work in progress until the last breath I take on this earth. And with God's grace, I'll be able to do that. I love AA. I love being a part of it. I love sharing it. AA has given me everything I have in this world today. I've received a lot of honors. I've been members of a lot of prestigious groups. In 2000, my old buddy Tom Brokaw and I were both inducted together into the Georgia Broadcasting Hall of Fame. I'm proud of that honor, but I'll tell you that. You can have that honor and all the others if you leave me my membership in Alcoholics Anonymous, because this is my life. It saved a marriage that was wrecked. I had a daughter who had written in her diary, "I wish my daddy was dead." And today I have a wonderful relationship with my daughter. I have two beautiful grandsons who have never known their drunk granddaddy as a drunk. I was not a very good daddy the first 12 years of my daughter's life, but I'm a damn good granddaddy. I never give those boys a single thing in the world they don't want. My daughter says, "Daddy, you're spoiling them rotten." I said, "Yeah, honey, it's payback time." I owe everything that I am and I have to AA. And that's why, as a part of my morning prayers and meditation, when I get up and have my little morning chat with God, I always remember to say, "Thank you, dear God, because I almost missed all this." God bless you.